Growing up in Pennsylvania coal country, writer Jennifer Haig learned that a lot of what matters in the state cannot be seen. It lies beneath the surface in the form of potential energy. She saw how the boom and bust cycles of mining affected the people of her town, which is now poised on the brink of fracking. She's taken what she knows and turned it into a novel called Heat and Light. The novel has just been released in paperback, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jennifer Haig to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you down this path of writing about this place that you've written about before, but to look at it in this context?
Well, this is a novel set in Western Pennsylvania, part of the world I grew up in. I wrote about it in its heyday in the coal mining era in the 1940s. And then later I wrote a book about what happened to the town after the coal mines died, how people continued on with life and figured out what to do next. And so for a long time I thought, I've said everything I have to say about this place. It seemed that nothing else was ever going to happen there. The town had lost so much population and it was ready to dry up and blow away. And then what happened in the mid-2000s was the gas drilling boom. Pennsylvania sits on top of the Marcellus Shale, and for people in these dying coal mining towns, the chance to lease their mineral rights seemed like winning the lottery. So it was a new story that came to me just through what was happening in the world, and it was too good to pass up.
The place is Bakerton, and give us a sense of the makeup, a little bit about the demographics of this place.
Well, the people living in Bakerton circa 2016, are the people who are left. You know, three generations ago, this was a booming coal mining town. The population at that time was five times what it is now. And so what you have there are the embers of a town. Most of the younger generation has long since gone. There are some young families who were trying to make a go of it there, but it's very hard because this was always a company town. And how you make a living there in the absence of coal mining isn't obvious.
So the Marcellus Shale boom certainly became a game changer. And it could provide a third act for this particular community and for many communities throughout that region and along this ridge. So for you, how much did you know going into it about fracking? And another way of asking the question is where did you have a side, if you will, as to this procedure, this controversial procedure, and how it was impacting this place where you grew up?
I had a superficial understanding of how fracking worked. I knew as much as the average person knows just from following the news. And I had this vague sense that this was a very bad thing, it was dangerous to the environment, and nobody should do it. But I couldn't have explained to you why it was so bad, just that it was somehow dangerous. So that's where I started from. I really had a layperson's understanding of the subject. And in order to write this book, I had to educate myself about it. This was a long research and writing process for me. It took me about 5 years, in which time I did absolutely nothing else but write this book. And for a lot of that time, I was asking a lot of stupid questions. I interviewed a lot of people who work in the industry, people who live in communities where this is happening, about how it has changed their lives, landowners who have leased their mineral rights and landowners who've decided not to. And in the process of doing all this research, I heard so many different perspectives on this issue. And it really changed the way I thought about it. This book is unusual for me in that it has so many different points of view. There are like 12 different point of view characters. So you're seeing the story through many different characters' eyes. And that was necessary for me in order to do justice to this very complicated topic. There was no way a single character could be my eyes and ears for the entire story. It's far too complicated. So I have a character who is an organic dairy farmer who decides not to lease her mineral rights and who becomes active in protesting gas drilling in the community. I have a character who's the CEO of a gas company. I have a landman who is in the business of buying up leases in this town. I have landowners who've gone ahead and leased their mineral rights and have gas rigs in their backyards. So it's, you know, it's a complicated story. It has a lot of moving parts.
When I read the book when it was first released, I remember thinking, I saw a review a short time later in which they referred to it as a fracking novel. And I thought that doesn't hit it, does it? Because it is, I guess fracking is the catalyst here, but because of those points of view, it's very much about the relationships between the people in this town.
It is. And, you know, when I started writing the book, I did think of it as a fracking novel. And, you know, 6 years ago when I first sat down to write. And in the process of writing it, it became something much larger than that. What fascinated me at the outset was how the fracking story has played out so differently in Pennsylvania than in New York State, just next door.
Right.
In New York, there was a very well-organized, effective protest movement, and ultimately the movement succeeded. There is a moratorium on fracking in the state of New York. We expect it will be in place as long as Cuomo is governor. And so that's how the story unfolded in New York. Just over the border in Pennsylvania, it's been a very different conversation. And I found myself wondering why it's so different. And the conclusion I came to is that, unlike New York, Pennsylvania has always been an energy state from the beginning.
Mm.
Most people don't know this, but the first oil well in the world was drilled in western Pennsylvania. Then there was 150 years of coal mining. There was deep mining. There was strip mining. Then there was the Three Mile Island nuclear disaster. So the story of energy in Pennsylvania has been ongoing for centuries, and this gas drilling question is just the latest chapter. So because people in Pennsylvania come to it from that perspective, they have, I think, a different tolerance for the kind of environmental effects that you see with gas drilling. That there is a kind of binary thinking that happens in a town like Bakerton. I know this is true because I grew up there.
Right.
These are my people. In the history of the town, prosperity has always come with a side order of environmental devastation. Coal mining was not a clean industry. And yet, the people in this town remember the mining years as a very good time. So it comes down to, I think for a lot of people, a choice between living in a town that is prosperous and filthy, or destitute and perfectly clean.
Mm.
That seems to be the choice that they are faced with. And that goes a long way toward explaining why people in this town are willing to accept a certain level of risk to the environment, to the water table. You know, fracking is not a clean business, and people know that. But it seems to them the price you pay for progress.
It's one of the things that fascinated me about the novel, because I kept on thinking about, because in some ways it's like the lottery. So you buy the ticket, you win, and you have this influx of cash. But except with the lottery, it was just that investment of a dollar. And here, that investment is so much more. And yet, some people in your novel are willing to look at that and consider what that investment means. And others just say, okay, show me the cash. Mm. There is a quandary there, isn't there?
There is. And it's complicated by the fact that in a community where gas drilling is happening, everybody is affected.
Yeah.
So a few people own enough land in exactly the right place that they can lease their mineral rights and make a lot of money. That does happen. The problem is everybody else in town is affected by the consequences. Everybody else has to drink the water. Everybody else is driving on these roads that are, you know, devastated by truck traffic. Everybody else is dealing with the constant noise and the Klieg lights 24/7. And it is very disruptive to the life of a community. And so the benefits are not spread around fairly. It's just a few people making a lot of money.
Jennifer Haig is our guest. The name of the novel is Heat and Light. This is also a story very much about addiction, and which is very real in small towns across this country and is very real in Bakerton. And I'm hoping you'll talk a little bit about how these two subjects come together.
I did not set out to write a novel about addiction. it's one of those discoveries I made in the process of writing the book, that addiction really is at the heart of this story. As you say, small-town America has been hit hard, particularly by the methamphetamine epidemic. That has certainly happened in Bakerton. And, you know, it's happened for the obvious reasons and maybe some less obvious reasons. The main character in this novel is a prison guard named Rich Devlin. Mm. His father was a coal miner. Both of his grandfathers were coal miners. The Devlins have been a mining family, you know, for three generations. And now it's no longer possible to make a living in the mines. So Rich's father basically invested his savings in buying a tavern and runs a bar. His older son is a prison guard in a facility full of drug offenders. And his younger son is a recovering heroin addict who works as a counselor in a methadone clinic. So here you have what was once a mining family, now entirely employed in the addictions business. It's the one industry that has been thriving in this community in the last 25 years.
And there is certainly that connection between how, just as you describe these, whether it be gas drilling or coal or even nuclear, that we are poisoning our land, and the connection to us willingly poisoning our bodies.
Right, willingly and knowingly. I mean, on its face, addiction, it's confounding. It you know, it's acting in opposition to our best interests, that we know we are poisoning ourselves by drinking too much or doing drugs or whatever, and yet the compulsion is very strong. And I thought a lot about how we are, as a society, really addicted to energy. You know, we need it. We can't function without it. And we are willing to go to some extraordinary lengths to get it. You know, fracking is a very expensive, complex process. These are deposits of gas that we've known for a very long time that they were down there. But until the 1990s, nobody had the slightest idea how we'd ever get it out. So fracking is a pretty elaborate technology to solve this problem. An awful lot of ingenuity went into developing this, and an awful lot of money.
Also, that idea that addiction, that the supply of the drugs is an industry in the town, one that could be replaced by, perhaps, by fracking and by the oil production. But then the question becomes, well, would it, number one? And two, is that really a decision? You know, is it one devil versus the other?
Right, right. If only it were that simple. Well, you know, part of the problem is that the gas industry has promised a lot to these towns. And I think a lot of people have accepted the industry, believing that it was going to be like the returning of coal mining, that whole communities were going to be employed, that there was going to be job security, you know, the kind of good union jobs that mine workers had a couple generations ago. And that has really not been the case. As I said earlier, fracking, it's tech intensive, it's machinery intensive, it's capital intensive, but it is not labor intensive in the same way that coal mining is. You know, a coal mine can employ 800 people, one mine. There are five guys on a drilling rig. So it's you know, an entirely different model. And even best case scenario, it's never going to employ entire communities the way coal mining did. Mm. And people who believe that have been sorely disappointed by it. Yes, it has been an economic boon to some of these communities. Yes, restaurants are doing a good business, and you know, Motel 6 is doing a good business, and convenience stores and gas stations and 84 Lumber, you know, any place that sells building materials. People who have a commercial license and can drive a truck can sometimes find a job that way. But it's piecemeal at best. There is an economic benefit to the community, but that also is not spread around evenly, and it has not translated into widespread employment.
You talked a moment ago about the characters and these points of view. There is such a great diversity in the characters in the novel, which I found really interesting. And when I think about it, in just looking at the at what we saw in our last election is that these small rural communities are far more complex than we give them credit for.
It's true. We have this impression that small towns are homogeneous, and they're not. As a product of a small town, I feel I can say this, that when you grow up in a small town, everybody knows your business. So maybe you're a little bit more careful about hiding your business. And so there's maybe a greater pressure toward conformity on the surface. But in fact, people in small towns are as diverse as people in cities, and not always in ways that you can see. For instance, I have a character in the book who I and most people I know would describe as transgender. She does not describe herself that way. She doesn't know that term. She's never changed her pronouns. But yet, in fact, that is what she is. She's a person born biologically female who lives as a man with a female partner. Calls herself her, would never call herself transgender, but she in fact is. And this is not so exotic. This has been happening in small towns for generations. It's not a recent invention, and it's not an urban phenomenon. And, one of the things I do in this book is look at how wrinkly and complicated small towns can be.
Because we so often go to that idea of red or blue, and is it a red town, is it a blue town? And when I think of Pennsylvania, I grew up in Philadelphia, and I remember I've heard it during this latest election cycle where you had James Carville, who said that famously that Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, you have Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and then Alabama in between. And it's far more complex than that, although it is a fairly true rule of thumb, right?
Yes, I think there's a lot of truth in that. As I was writing this story, I slowly came to understand how much the fracking story is a story about class. And this is a subject I return to again and again in my work. It's a subject Americans are very uncomfortable talking about. We all subscribe to the fantasy that we don't have a class system in this country, that we are a meritocracy, it's completely egalitarian. We're just beginning to talk about race in America. We're, I think, decades away from having an honest conversation about class. Mm-hmm. And yet class is at the root of a lot of the division in our society. We certainly saw it in the last election. And you see it in the way the fracking issue plays out. What strikes me is that a lot of the environmental activists who come to these towns to convince the locals that fracking is a bad idea come from an entirely different class background from the people they're preaching to. So the activists tend to be very well educated, politically to the left, people who live in cities, and they're coming to these small towns with very little understanding of the local culture and telling people what is good for them and what they should believe and how they should do. And predictably, that doesn't always go over so well.
Right. And the idea that it's I was struck by what you said about class, because often it's gone into as this is a political issue. And it's so much more than that. You can't just look at it as a political issue.
No, you can't.
In that exploration, I'm curious as to how much, obviously growing up there, a lot of it is innate for you, right? That you just know it. So for you, the research was mostly about fracking, about that whole issue and the sides and people coming in, but the place you had, what challenges did that present for you?
Well, I feel a great obligation to that part of the world. The stakes are very high for me. It's very important to me that I represent it fairly, that I do it right. And maybe I feel that more acutely because it's where my family lives. It's where I grew up. It's a place that is dear to me. So in that way, there's a little more pressure on me as a writer. Also, though, because I've written two other books set in this town, I have this very elaborate mental catalog of names and family histories mm-hmm. from this fictionalized place. Mm-hmm. So in Heat and Light, I'm writing about some characters whose grandparents appeared two books ago. And I have to keep those timelines straight. I have to remember you know, who was married to whom and how many children they had. And it is this kind of elaborate form of mental illness. I'm curating these lists and lists of imaginary people. And it's unlikely that any reader is going to read closely enough that she'd notice if I got something wrong, but I would notice. So this this kind of elaborate concordance of names has become very central to what I do as a fiction writer.
The idea of an industry coming into a town and splitting it into two, how do you look at that of what the long-term effects are on a community when that happens? Is it irreparable? Or is the jury still out?
It's impossible to know for sure, but I do want to say that this is the fragmentation of these communities is something that's been happening for a very long time.
Mm.
You know, partly it has to do with technology, with, you know, how much of our time we spend alone in our houses streaming videos or surfing the internet, that we all, whether we're rural or urban, we all live much more insular lives, I think, than we did a couple generations ago. So I think already this sense of community is somewhat weakened. And you see this in the novel, compared to my earlier novel, Baker Towers, set in the 1940s, when this was a company town with one industry, everybody worked in the mines together, everybody's kids went to school together. There was a real cohesiveness to the community because everybody's interests were identical. Everybody played on the same team. And that has long since stopped being the case in Bakerton. So, you know, when people feel insecure and resources are scarce, it's a natural human impulse to look out for your own. And that's what you see happening in the community in this book, where there is a lot of conflict between neighbors, that nobody is worried about what is best for this town. It's, you know, what can I get out of this?
Do you like writing, given the other two novels that you mentioned? This is your fifth novel, I believe. So do you like writing the contemporary?
I do. It's challenging in a way, though, because it's a moving target.
Mm.
And, you know, the world keeps turning while you're writing a book. And if you spend 5 years writing a novel, the picture is likely to change dramatically while you're still in the process of writing it. So it's more challenging in a way.
And what do you worry about in that scenario? Is it that something will become outdated, the technology will change, that a cultural idea will change even in that time?
Not so much that. I worry about not having the perspective of history. It's easy to misjudge what's in front of you if you don't have enough distance from which to see
mm-hmm.
it. And sometimes it's hard to know what an event actually means when you're still in the throes of it. So when you're writing about events in the past, you know, you have this benefit of long hindsight, and it's a great gift to a writer.
So what is next for you?
Oh, there will be another novel. I don't think it will be a Bakerton book anytime soon. Every time I write about this place, I think, okay, that's it. I'm done. I am never writing another book set in this town. But I say that every time, so don't believe me. I probably am wrong about that. What has happened for me over the years, I find myself toggling back and forth between Bakerton, Pennsylvania, and Boston, where I have lived for 16 years. Boston is a really fertile subject for me. It's a really interesting and weird place, and I've set two novels there already, so I suspect the next one will be a Boston novel.
Jennifer Haig's new novel is Heat and Light. It is now out in paperback and published by Echo. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.